All right, let's jump into a case that really gets to the core of tribal sovereignty and state authority. We're talking Cotton Petroleum Corp. v. New Mexico, a 1989 Supreme Court decision that still has ripple effects today, especially when you're dealing with anything on tribal lands.
Yeah, it's a case that really kind of throws a wrench into this whole idea of federalism. You know, it shows how those lines between tribal, state, and federal powers can get, well, a little blurry.
Definitely blurry. To set the stage, we've got Cotton Petroleum, which is a non-Indian company.
Right.
They're leasing 15,000 acres.
Wow.
On the Jicarilla Apache Reservation in New Mexico. They're doing oil and gas production. That's a huge operation. You can already kind of get a sense of the money we're talking about here.
And it's important to note that Cotton Petroleum, they weren't trying to get out of paying the tribe. They were paying rent and royalties and even a 6% severance tax on all that oil and gas, which for the Jicarilla Apache, that was a major, major source of income.
Yeah, absolutely. But then New Mexico comes in and says, hold on a second, we want a piece of this too. They slap an additional 8% severance tax on top of what Cotton was already paying to the tribes.
Yeah.
Essentially double taxation, which of course Cotton Petroleum is not happy about.
Of course not.
They say, hey, this is violating federal law. This is violating the Constitution.
Yeah.
They're saying this is an unfair burden on interstate commerce, especially because producers who aren't operating on reservations aren't dealing with this double taxation.
Right, yeah.
So you've got the tribe depending on this money. You've got the state saying, well, we provide services too, like roads, environmental oversight, so we deserve our cut. Was this a legitimate argument, or were they overstepping?
Well, that's the million-dollar question that the Supreme Court had to grapple with. I mean, it gets even trickier when you consider all the legal issues in play, because it's not just about money. It goes to the heart of how we understand tribal sovereignty, you know, how it interacts with state and federal power.
Exactly, exactly. So let's kind of unpack those legal threads. First, we've got this concept of federal preemption. Does a federal law, like the Indian Mineral Leasing Act of 1938 that governs this kind of mineral leasing, prevent the states from imposing these taxes?
Mm-hmm.
Is federal law supreme here?
Yeah, that was a big one. And then there's the Commerce Clause. This one's all about Congress's power to regulate commerce between the states, but it also gets applied to tribal lands, which gets kind of tricky. So does this double taxation situation unfairly burden interstate commerce? That's another question.
Yeah, it's already getting complex, and we haven't even touched the Indian Commerce Clause yet.
Oh, yeah, the Indian Commerce Clause. This one always makes people scratch their heads. It's all about whether tribes should be treated like states when it comes to their power to tax. A whole other layer of complexity here.
It's a constitutional puzzle box.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court has to figure out how to open it. So what was the verdict?
Well, they sided with New Mexico, 7-2.
What?
Yeah, a pretty big win for the state. They upheld that additional 8% tax. Justice Stevens wrote the majority opinion. And it's important to understand his reasoning because it really set the stage for how these cases are viewed even today.
Okay, so let's break down Justice Stevens' opinion. What were his main arguments for allowing this double taxation to stand?
Well, he started by addressing that preemption issue. He said there was no clear federal law that actually prohibited state taxes in the specific situation.
Mm.
The 1938 Act, the one everyone was looking at, it didn't specifically talk about state taxes. So the court said, well, Congress must not have intended to block them.
So because Congress didn't say no, the court said it was a yes for the states.
Basically. And then Stevens went on to talk about tribal sovereignty, which is, you know, a super sensitive topic. He argued that letting the state impose this tax didn't actually step on the tribe's right to govern itself.
Okay, but how did he square that? I mean, the state is taking a cut of the tribe's revenue.
Well, he had two reasons. First, he said the tribe could still impose their own taxes on Cotton Petroleum, so it wasn't like they were losing all their power to tax.
Right.
And second, he pointed out that New Mexico was providing some of those substantial services, like you said, roads and stuff.
So it sounds like they were trying to find a compromise, acknowledging both the tribe's sovereignty and the state's interests.
Exactly. Trying to balance those competing interests. And then, when it came to the Commerce Clause argument, Stevens said, look, just because there are two taxes doesn't automatically mean it's an unfair burden on interstate commerce.
Okay.
He said both the tribe and the state have the power to tax in this scenario. So, yeah, there's a higher overall tax burden, but that's just what happens when you have these overlapping authorities.
So double taxation isn't ideal, but it's not unconstitutional. But didn't Cotton Petroleum argue that the state's tax should be, like, proportional to the services they're actually providing?
Oh, they did. And this is where it gets really interesting, especially if you're working with businesses on tribal land. The court actually rejected that proportionality argument.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They said states don't have to match the amount of tax they collect to the exact value of the services they provide.
So that seems like it could be a problem, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that could open the door for states to just impose high taxes without actually providing the services.
You're hitting on a key point there, and we'll definitely explore those implications in the next part of our deep dive. But for now, the main thing to understand is that the court really emphasized this idea of concurrent jurisdiction, meaning both the state and the tribe can tax in this situation.
Okay, so we've got Justice Stevens and the majority saying the state has the right to tax. But this wasn't a unanimous decision, right? There was a dissenting opinion that offered a different take on this whole situation.
Right. Justice Blackmun wrote a pretty powerful dissent that gets to the core of this tension between what's good for the tribes economically and what the states want in terms of revenue. He argued that the whole purpose of that 1938 Act was to help tribes make money from their resources.
Makes sense.
And he said letting states impose additional taxes just undermines that goal.
So basically he's saying state taxes are working against the federal policy that's supposed to help tribes.
Exactly. And he was worried this ruling would ultimately weaken tribal self-governance, making it harder for them to develop their own economies and, you know, take care of their people.
So his dissent raises some serious concerns about the impact on tribal sovereignty and economic development.
It does. It makes us think about this bigger question. How do we balance tribal sovereignty with state interests in a way that's actually fair? And what are the long-term consequences for these communities?
So we're kind of left with this cliffhanger. The majority emphasizes the state's right to tax, but then you have Blackmun highlighting the potential harm to the tribes.
Yeah.
Where do we go from here?
Well, that's where things get really interesting. Stay tuned for part two, where we'll explore the lasting impact of cotton petroleum and what it means for the future of tribal-state relations. We'll look at how this case is still shaping legal battles today and what challenges and opportunities it creates for both tribes and businesses.
Sounds like we've got a lot more ground to cover.
Yeah.
We'll see you back here soon for part two of our deep dive into cotton petroleum. Welcome back, everyone. Last time we were talking about the Supreme Court's decision in cotton petroleum and kind of that back and forth between the majority opinion and that really interesting dissent.
It was a decision that really got people talking, especially in Indian country, and it still shapes how we think about the power balance between states and tribes.
Absolutely. And the thing is, it wasn't just about a tax dispute, right? It set a precedent that courts are still trying to figure out. What's really fascinating to me is how cotton petroleum is still shaping the legal landscape, even beyond oil and gas.
Yeah, that's right. It's like the effects are still rippling outwards. Cotton petroleum didn't really create a hard and fast rule. It created this flexible approach for dealing with these state-tribal conflicts, so there's no easy answer.
So instead of having clear rules, courts have to weigh all these different factors and interests depending on the specific case.
Exactly. And that can make things super complicated for everyone involved, from the tribes to the businesses trying to work within this legal framework. It creates uncertainty because you don't always know how a case is going to turn out.
Yeah, it seems like a judge's interpretation could really sway things one way or another, since there isn't this clear-cut rule to follow.
That's true. And that's why you need judges who really understand Indian law and are aware of the unique situations that tribes face. It's not just about the law. It's about history, culture, sovereignty.
It makes me think that maybe Congress should step in and give more specific guidance. You know, if there were clear federal policies, maybe there wouldn't be so much uncertainty.
I think that would make a huge difference. And remember, cotton petroleum was about oil and gas, but what it says applies to other resources found on tribal land, too.
That's what I was thinking about. We're talking about tribal lands, which have all kinds of valuable stuff, not just fossil fuels. What about things like timber or minerals used in technology, even water rights? Does cotton petroleum have anything to say about state taxes on those?
Oh, absolutely. Those basic ideas from the case, the flexible approach, looking at state services, the possibility of both the state and tribe taxing it applies to any resource you can think of on tribal land.
So let's imagine a tribe decides to build a wind farm on their reservation to create clean energy. Could the state come in and say, we're taxing that operation, even though it's on tribal land?
Under cotton petroleum, it's possible. The state could argue they're providing stuff like, you know, access to the power grid, transmission lines, things like that, and that would justify their tax.
And then the courts would have to decide if that outweighs the tribe's right to develop their resources and make money for their people. That seems like a recipe for conflict.
Definitely. And as technology changes and we see new industries popping up on tribal lands, these questions are only going to get more complicated. Think about mining for a rare earth mineral used in phones and computers, or setting up big data centers.
So this one case from 1989 is still affecting how we deal with economic development and resources on tribal lands today. It shows just how much impact these Supreme Court decisions can have.
Totally. Cotton Petroleum created a framework, but it's a framework that can be a double-edged sword. It recognizes tribal sovereignty, but it also lets states get involved, sometimes in a way that hurts the tribes.
It goes back to that core issue of tribal sovereignty. If states can tax businesses on tribal land, doesn't that weaken a tribe's ability to govern itself and control its own future?
It's a balancing act, and some people say that Cotton Petroleum gave too much power to the states, but it did acknowledge that tribal sovereignty is important, even if it didn't fully protect it in that specific case.
So it wasn't a complete win for the states, but wasn't a loss for the tribes either. It's this in-between area where there's a lot of negotiation and legal maneuvering going on.
Exactly. And that's why understanding cases like Cotton Petroleum is so important. They help us make sense of these complicated questions, even if they don't give us clear-cut answers.
It sounds like tribes need to be really careful when they make deals about resources on their land and be ready to fight back if a state tries to take too much.
Absolutely. They have to understand that states might try to tax them and be ready to challenge those taxes, and they need to work with Congress to get federal protections for their economic interests.
You know, it makes you wonder if there's a better system out there, one where tribes have more control over their own resources and their futures without having to constantly defend their rights in court, a system that really respects their sovereignty.
That's a really big question. It's something that people who make policy and legal experts are thinking about right now. As tribal economies change and grow, the laws that govern state-tribal relations will need to change too.
This whole conversation makes me think about casinos, which have become really important for a lot of tribes. We've seen this explosion of tribal casinos all over the country. Does Cotton Petroleum affect how states tax those casinos? I bet those casinos make a lot of money that states want a cut of.
That's a great point. And it takes us into one of the most debated areas of state-tribal relations. The whole casino industry has created a bunch of new legal problems and some pretty intense fights between states and tribes about who gets to tax the money.
Ooh, sounds like there's some legal drama brewing there. I want to hear more about that.
Oh, there's plenty of drama. But before we jump into the world of casinos and taxes, let's take a minute to think about what we've learned so far. We'll be back in a flash to talk about how Cotton Petroleum has affected the way states try to get their hands on those casino profits.
All right, sounds like we're about to hit the jackpot of legal intrigue. Don't go anywhere, folks. All right, so let's get back to this whole casino thing. We were talking about how states are trying to get a piece of the action, even though tribes have the right to run their own gaming operations. It seems like it goes against the whole idea of tribal self-governance.
It's definitely a clash of powers. And yeah, it seems like it contradicts everything we've discussed about tribal sovereignty, right?
Right.
But remember, Cotton Petroleum established that flexible approach and basically said states can tax activities on tribal lands as long as they're providing certain services.
Yeah.
So that idea has definitely carried over into the gaming world. But there are a few twists.
Okay, so are states just seeing all this casino money and thinking, we want some of that too?
Yeah, kind of, but it's not quite that simple. Luckily, states can't just take a chunk of casino profits whenever they want. Things are a little more structured than that, thanks to the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, or IGRA.
Ah, yes, IGRA. Another one of those legal acronyms. What does IGRA have to do with all of this?
Basically, IGRA is the rule book for tribal gaming in the U.S. It says tribes have the right to regulate gaming on their lands, but it also sets up a framework for them to work with states.
Okay.
And a big part of that is negotiating something called tribal-state compacts.
Compacts, so like official agreements between the tribe and the state.
Exactly. These compacts are super important because they lay out the rules for how tribes can offer different types of gaming, and a lot of times they include stuff about revenue sharing.
Revenue sharing, so the state gets a cut of the profits instead of directly taxing the casino. That seems a little less aggressive.
Yeah. But here's where that Cotton Petroleum thinking comes back in. States often say they deserve some of that revenue because guess what? They're providing services that help the casinos, like roads and police and even regulatory stuff.
So it's the same argument they use for the oil and gas taxes. They're just applying it to casinos now.
Exactly. It's the same flexible approach, but instead of a separate tax, it's usually part of these compacts that are negotiated between the tribe and the state.
So it's more like a settlement than the state just forcing its way in.
In theory, yes. But these negotiations can get pretty intense. States often have a lot of power because they can threaten to block certain types of gaming if the tribe doesn't agree to their terms.
Wait, that doesn't seem fair. It sounds like states are kind of bullying tribes into deals that might not be good for them. How is that allowed?
It definitely raises some concerns about whether these compacts are really being negotiated fairly, and it highlights how there's this power imbalance between states and tribes, even when we're talking about tribal sovereignty.
So if a tribe feels like a state is trying to push them around during these compact negotiations, can they fight back? Can they take it to court?
Oh, they definitely can, and they often do. But here's the thing. Cotton Petroleum is kind of looming over these cases. Remember, the court said states do have a right to be involved in taxing stuff on tribal lands, even if it's making money for the tribe.
So even though IGRA gives tribes the power over gaming, Cotton Petroleum gives states an excuse to say, we want a piece of the pie too. That seems kind of messed up.
That's basically the argument states are making. And generally, courts have agreed with them. As long as these revenue-sharing deals are part of a negotiated compact and don't put too much of a burden on the tribe, they're usually considered okay.
It feels like tribes are stuck in this constant battle trying to exercise their sovereignty and make money for their communities while also having to deal with states that want a cut of the profits.
It's a difficult situation, for sure. And Cotton Petroleum is still a major factor even after all this time. It shows how tribal sovereignty, even though it's recognized by law, can be limited in practice.
It makes you think there should be a better system, something where tribes have more control and don't always have to go to court to defend their rights, a system that really respects their sovereignty.
That's a big question, and it's something people are working on right now. As tribal economies evolve and become more complex, the laws governing state-tribal relations will need to catch up.
Wow, we've covered a lot today. From oil and gas to casinos, it's been quite a deep dive. I feel like I've learned more about tribal law in the past hour than I did in all of law school.
It's a fascinating area of law, and it's constantly changing. But hopefully we've shed some light on the key issues and challenges. And most importantly, I hope we've inspired our listeners to learn more about this important topic.
I agree. To all our listeners out there, keep those legal minds sharp, stay curious, and remember, context is everything when it comes to tribal law. And that's a wrap for today's deep dive. We'll see you next time for another fascinating exploration of the legal world.